This morning, we welcome Reverend Denise Gouch as our speaker. Reverend Gouch has been a member of the First UU Church of Nashville since 2001. She earned the Master of Divinity degree from Vanderbilt University in 2011, and she was ordained to the UU ministry jointly by the First UU Nashville and the UU Church of Huntsville, Alabama in 2015. Her primary passion these days is supporting the growth of Unitarian Universalism in Middle Tennessee and the Southern region. Reverend Gouch will speak on the topic, How We Save Christmas. Let's welcome Reverend Gouch.
Good morning. It is always so much fun to be here with you, and the holiday season is really fun. I've always loved Christmas. I have to say, this is not quite the talk I thought I was going to put together once I started getting into it. I thought, when I chose my title, that I was going to tell a story about how the Puritans were spoil sports and the Unitarians who, you know, Unitarianism and Universalism both came out of Puritan Congregationalism in New England. And I thought, you know, the Unitarians and the Universalists sort of, you know, got the Puritans over this not liking to celebrate Christmas. And we sort of rescued the Christmas celebration from Puritan just dour
tyranny.
Okay, tyranny. I was going to say just sort of bad humor, but tyranny works. What I found actually was that I needed to retitle my talk, and now the title is something like "How We Saved the Christmas That Never Was," because I think sometimes, as you use today, in the middle of the time we live in, we feel like we're sort of outsiders to the Christmas celebration, that we don't necessarily all buy into the true meaning of Christmas. About 10 years ago, there was a lot of battle for Christmas. But we actually are responsible for, our religious tradition is directly responsible in many ways for the typical, what is now the typical American celebration of Christmas. And so I don't think we need to be nearly as sheepish as we are about claiming Christmas and the Christmas holidays, and also the way Christmas as a holiday is connected to all the other midwinter holidays, and the fact that we like to celebrate them all together. And if you want to say happy holidays, you say happy holidays. If you want to say Merry Christmas, you say Merry Christmas. Because there's, if you want to say, happy solstice, good Yule, there is, in our tradition, there is room and grounding for all of that. So here's how we saved the Christmas that never was. Reverend Nathan Dietering says, "The true Christmas that was only about Jesus or only about spiritual matters never really existed. In fact, Christmas over the centuries has always been a hodgepodge of celebrations and merriment." So here's a quick history of Christmas. So Christmas, as December 25th, was designated in the 4th century by the Roman Empire as, you know, Christmas, the birth, the celebration, actually the word didn't exist yet, right? The word Christmas. Yeah, well, but it wasn't even called that then. Back in the 4th century, they just said, the birth of Christ, let's do it on December 25th. Which somebody, I just learned this last week, somebody told me the calendars moved around a lot, you know, over the years. At that time, December 25th was the solstice. Now the solstice is a few days off from December 25th. But it wasn't an accident. It actually was a very clear attempt to co-opt the old pagan midwinter holidays and transform them into a Christian identity. The 4th century is when the Roman Empire, Christianity gained official standing, and there was an attempt to kind of bring everybody along, fold everything in. But it was based on the old pagan midwinter holidays, okay? And nobody, everybody knew that. There has always, throughout all the centuries, and especially in the medieval West, Western Europe, there's always been tension between excess at Christmas time as a necessary social release valve, and this excess as immorality. So, and by excess, we mean kind of, it's pretty standard list. Drinking, gambling, staying out late, making lots of noise. Now, we have Christmas caroling now, which has kind of stayed. Everybody gets wrapped up warm and goes outside and politely sings at people's front doors. And we say, oh, that has its old roots in the tradition of wassailing, right? Here we go, well, wassailing, yeah. Well, wassailing wasn't quite as polite as Christmas caroling. It was basically roving bands of young men who would go and say you're in a little town. You'd go to the Lord's house, the big manor house, and you wouldn't really knock politely on the door. You would go in. You were expected. It was kind of everybody played this game, but you would go in, and you would expect to be given wine or whatever the best drinks available were, the best, you know, the foods, all the fancy foods that the people in the big house got to eat more regularly than you did anyway, but you would expect to get those. And if you didn't, that was considered a sign of really bad faith and not disrespect, and you would probably retaliate. It's actually a lot like the idea of trick-or-treating, which now has become very polite also, but wasn't always. So that's what wassailing really was. And actually in that, you know, here we come a wassailing, there are some hints of that older sort of tradition in there. But there was also a lot of just general drinking and gambling, going abroad at night, sort of code for it, loud explosions. That, like our 4th of July, actually. It's very common, the celebration of Christmas. And that's just kind of, you know, and the different regions had different ways of celebrating. That's how we have all these, you know, different Christmas in different lands kind of things. But it wasn't ever really a solidly religious, you know, not everywhere. It wasn't everywhere and always a solidly religious thing. There was also all this other carousing going on. In England, during the Radical Reformation, actually England and John Calvin in Switzerland, there were actually attempts by some people. In England, it was the Puritans who tried to abolish Christmas celebrations. They said, look, it is nowhere in the Bible that Jesus was born on December 25th. There is nothing in the Bible about celebrating Christmas. We ought not to do it. There's all this immoral behavior. There's all these babies being born in September and October. And no, we're not going to do this. So the Puritans and John Calvin tried to downplay, but outlaw the celebration of Christmas on December 25th. They said, this is pagan. It's tied to these old pagan celebrations that have nothing to do with Christianity. And worse, it's popish or papist. You know, the Roman Catholics do it. And Roman Catholics, in fact, do. And I grew up Roman Catholic, and I remember Christmas is a big churchy thing. And you've got 4 weeks before where you're thinking about it. And you've got all these holidays afterwards. It's a big churchy thing. They said, we are not Catholic. We are better than that. We don't need to celebrate Christmas. So in New England, now we're over in the colonies, during the 17th century, Christmas was actually illegal in the Massachusetts Bay Colony from 1659 to 1681. You could get fined 5 shillings, which I understand was a blow if you were poor or just regular, I think. So it was your shops had to be open. You had to show up for work. You weren't supposed to go abroad at night, carousing, drinking, singing, making loud noises. And if you were caught, you were in trouble. And the law was really only repealed after the Puritans in English history. The Puritans dethroned the monarch and took over the government for a while. And it was only in 81 when the monarchy was restored that the Massachusetts Bay Colony repealed their Christmas laws because they knew they couldn't really enforce them with the new governor. In the mid-Atlantic colonies and the South, Christmas was always celebrated in traditional ways, which means gambling, drinking, going abroad at night, loud noises, and only by some people. It wasn't a big deal. Businesses were also open. The Continental Congress met. You know, I mean, legislatures met still. There were traditional ways of celebrating Christmas happened, but they weren't such a big deal. Remember George Washington crossing the Delaware on Christmas Eve? He could do that because it wasn't that huge a deal to celebrate Christmas Eve and Christmas Day for the American soldiers. The Hessians, however, were Roman Catholic. They were celebrating Christmas Eve. They didn't notice. They didn't occur to them somebody would do something like attack on Christmas Day. So There you go. There really isn't any consistency is the point of all this. There's no such thing as a typical American Christmas in the colonial period. One of the commentators I read wrote, the only consistency was that when Americans celebrated a holiday in a local community, drinking, fighting, and squandering of money was the routine way to behave. And I would add loud explosions. But Universalists, who were largely rural, a lot of the traditions of celebrating Christmas in the middle of the winter were tied to the old rural and agricultural customs. When you think about it, if you work really hard on the land growing things, about now you're done, and there's not much to do for a while. So that's where a lot of these customs come from. Universalist congregations in the United States were largely in rural areas, and they openly celebrated Christmas from their beginnings in the late 18th. Yeah, their beginnings in the late 18th century. In 1789, there was a Universalist church in Boston, and they held the first Christmas Day church service in that city. And they held it specifically as an alternative to immorality, i.e. the drinking, the gambling, the loud noises and the rowdiness. The Unitarians followed suit soon after that, and by the early 1800s, Unitarian congregations were calling for churches to be open on Christmas Day and for shops to be closed so folks could spend time with their families. Now, the whole family thing is a little bit new in the Christmas constellation. And it turned out that it was much easier to shift celebrations of Christmas to the home than to the church. And, you know, I kind of have only recently become aware of this because, again, I grew up Catholic, so we went to church on Christmas Day, always, always, always. And it's been kind of strange to me to realize that for a lot of people, yeah, church on Christmas Day, I mean, I think y'all are not having church, you're going to IHOP. And a lot of Protestant churches won't be open on Christmas morning. They expect people to be at home with their families. So anyway, it turned out it was easier in the long run to sell people on the idea of the family Christmas at home as the alternative to the rowdiness, the drinking, the gambling, that stuff, than it was to get people to go to church. But even though Christmas grew farther and farther away from what is sort of recognizably religious and especially biblical practice, for Unitarians especially, the impetus toward holiday celebrations remained hugely moral. The point of holiday celebrations was the inculcation of good character. The 18th century Unitarians were, and 19th century especially, were real big on character. What is good character and how do you encourage it in people, especially in children? So celebrating Christmas was about encouraging people toward moral behavior and nurturing family affection and loyalty. And if you're starting to think of Little Women, you are on exactly the right track. Louisa May Alcott grew up in a Unitarian family, and that opening of Little Women is about a family at home celebrating Christmas and then taking their Christmas feast out to a poor family, you know, to another family to share, a family that was needy. So here you have sort of the close family, but also the emphasis on charity, as they would have said in the 19th century. What we think of now as the traditional American Christmas came together over several decades in the middle of the 19th century. So I see, from what I've read, kind of 1881, you have Harper's Weekly, it's a magazine, publishing Clement Clark Moore's poem, you know, A Visit from St. Nick, and with illustrations of a Santa Claus who looks kind of more like what we think of now as Santa Claus. And what's very interesting is in that those middle decades of the 19th century, rather, Unitarians were in the thick of all of this development of new pictures of Christmas, stories of Christmas, celebrations of Christmas, songs of Christmas. The Unitarians at that time were the cultural elite. They were the upper middle classes, the intellectuals, the trendsetters of society. So the history of our American Christmas celebrations is full of writers, poets, artists, and social activists and commentators who happened to be Unitarian. And that's really more than Universalist, really, at that point. So many of the hymns, the stories, the customs have specifically 19th century beginnings, and they seem to have been created, reinvented, or revived many times by Unitarian individuals. So, for example, the hymn we sang, I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day, Unitarian poet. It Came Upon a Midnight Clear was written by Edmund Hamilton Sears in 1849. It's thought to be a response to the Mexican War. But again, it emphasizes the angels and their message of peace on earth and goodwill to all. 20th century, so we're skipping ahead, in 1962, Do You Hear What I Hear? Was actually written by a UU singer-songwriter duo. Noel Regney and Gloria Shane Baker. So again, the emphasis is on peace and goodwill to all in the celebration of Christmas. Other Unitarian Christmas things that they're solidly mainstream American Christmas things are Over the River and Through the Woods. To Grandmother's House We Go. Unitarian writer. And Jingle Bells. Jingle Bells is a funny one. It was written by the brother and son of important Unitarian ministers and abolitionists. He was the music director. And there's actually, there's been sort of a running debate between a congregation in Massachusetts and the congregation in Savannah, Georgia, over which congregation is the home of Jingle Bells, which is totally secular. There is nothing religious in that song, really. And apparently he was kind of the black sheep of the family, too. He was the music director of the Savannah congregation. Some people have said, oh, yes, and the Sunday school children were the first ones to sing it. Well, maybe, but maybe not, because it's really a song about young people carousing. And, you know, Go It While You're Young is probably not something church parents would want their children to be singing. So who knows? But he was a Unitarian. He was not the good abolitionist that his brother and his father were. He was kind of a black sheep. James Pierpont. But there you go. He's Unitarian. So of this sort of cluster of UU songs that are actually American Christmas classics, two of those are totally secular, and the others are spiritual, maybe not religious. But they both emphasize peace. If they're both about morality and peace and justice and goodwill toward all. They're very much in line with our values. The Christmas tree. We can take credit for the Christmas tree as an American form of celebrating Christmas. Charles Fallon was an American Unitarian. He had immigrated from Germany. He was a German professor at Harvard. And in 1835, he had house guests who wrote popular descriptions that spread this custom. It was a German custom, and it was also about the same time starting to become popular in England as well. But he had in his house, it was actually on New Year's they did it because of somebody's schedule. Christmas Day wasn't good, so they did it on New Year's. But they put up a Christmas tree and they lit it with candles. And they hung the presents for the children on the trees. And they did it all so well that nothing except the petticoat on one doll's clothing got singed. So all that caught on fire was one doll's petticoat. But two of the people who were there were writers. They were women Unitarian writers, which is another mid-19th century cultural phenomenon where you have more women writing, more popular media, magazines and such, publishing things. And so Harriet Martineau, who was an English Unitarian abolitionist who was visiting Fallon, she wrote a description of the Christmas tree, which was very popular both in the States and in England. And Catherine Sedgwick, who was a popular American writer, wrote a fictionalized account of the Christmas tree and the lighting and the, you know, how the parents did it. The parents did it and they kept it secret and it was a big deal. And the children are having their tea and the parents are lighting the candles. They throw open the door and there's this beautiful tree with candles aglow and lots of presents. And it became very, it was just a very appealing image to a lot of Americans. And that custom of putting up Christmas trees and celebrating Christmas in the home with the children caught on. It's also, to me, it's interesting in the background of all of this is this was a cluster of people in that house that day who were all abolitionists. And being an abolitionist was kind of a chancy thing. It meant you weren't welcome in a lot of other people's houses at that time. This was in New England. So it's kind of interesting. Someday I want to dig a little deeper into that. Also, alongside the Christmas tree, the custom of gift giving within the family, of parents and children exchanging gifts, that was another German custom. Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who was a Romantic poet and philosopher and a Unitarian, visited Germany, and he saw German families exchanging gifts at Christmas time and wrote about that in the United States. It kind of caught on, and it reinforced these stories of the Christmas tree. Really, two big things that we all know about, but you may or may not know, are Unitarian derived, are the poem A Visit from St. Nicholas. You know, 'twas the night before Christmas and all through the house. That was written on December 23rd, 1823 by the New York Sentinel. And it was part of the creation of this idea of a traditional Dutch Christmas. In New York, it was part of the city of New York trying to get a cultural identity going. But it was a Dutch Christmas that never really was that way. But there was this brand new poem about it that really caught on. It's really catchy. I bet if you started, you could recite goodly chunks of it just like that. I know I can. And the other thing, in 1834, Dickens published A Christmas Carol. Charles Dickens. And we can claim him as Unitarian. He wasn't a lifelong Unitarian. He was Anglican, Church of England. He was an Englishman, right? But he visited the United States and met some Unitarians here and was very active with them while he was in the States. And when he went back to England, he did become a member of a Unitarian congregation in London for a while. By the time he died, he had gone back to Anglicanism. But he always admired Unitarians and Unitarianism. And I think it's safe. We're not sort of on some sort of, you know, he went to a Unitarian church once and we're going to claim him. He really was in line with Unitarianism for a good chunk of his life. And all of his writings line up pretty closely with a lot of our values as well. But A Christmas Carol is really, from one or two of the people I read, read it as a revival of old Christmas traditions that were nearly dead. It's Dickens remembering the Christmases of his very early youth. And some of that's even kind of accidental. Apparently one of his biographers notes that the first 8 years of his life, there would have been snow at Christmas time where he lived, which would not have been normal. So Dickens has these pictures from early childhood of very snowy Christmases, which he writes into A Christmas Carol. You remember the scenes with the Ghost of Christmas Past, where he's, you know, snowed in at the boarding school or whatever. But anyway, there's snow. There's lots of snow. But that wouldn't really be normal in most parts of England. But he's also bringing back some of the older celebrations of Christmas that his father would have known when his father lived in the country as a boy. And his father apparently loved Christmas. So some people think that Dickens actually sort of revives customs about Christmas that had actually been dying out. But he also, notably, in A Christmas Carol and in lots of his other works, he promotes moral solutions to social ills through fiction. So he tells these stories about people experiencing conversions, like Ebenezer Scrooge is one of the great conversion stories. And he's real interested in societal change through that personal transformation. One person realizes they've been thinking wrong, and they change and start interacting with the world differently. And Dickens reflects those central 19th century Unitarian values, which many of them are still ours, connection to all, everyone is connected. It's laughter. A lot of joy and lightness, and giving to others. These are big themes. So you have in the before the middle of the 19th century, you've got this visit from St. Nicholas and Christmas Carol, both of which were very popular and were printed and illustrated and republished over and over again. And then in the second half of that century, you have a political cartoonist named Thomas Nast. And he is responsible for, I think, our picture of what Santa Claus looks like. For 24 years, he published, in 1863 to 1886, he published pictures of Santa Claus for Harper's Weekly. And especially remember that 1881 publication of The Visit from St. Nick that I mentioned earlier. He illustrated that, "'Twas the Night Before Christmas" for Harper's Weekly in 1881. So one of our own Unitarian Universalist ministers, Jim Sherblom, says, "Nast turned Santa into a large, jolly, humanist depiction of joy, hope, peace, and goodwill for all humankind." Now, some people, somebody in the Tullahoma congregation said to me, "Well, I saw a display of all of Nast's Santa Clauses, and they were kind of scary." It's, getting from the early 19th century to the 20th century is, that's a big transformation. And also, I should note, Coca-Cola is actually responsible for the picture we now have. But Nast was the bridge between those old European ideas of St. Nicholas, who was a bishop, who was, a member of the elite, who wore clerical garb and probably was fairly serious and was all about charity more than jollity. Well, so Clement Clark Moore and Thomas Nast, between the two of them, transformed him into something else entirely. And in the poem, Santa's small. He's an elf, It says somewhere he's small. So Nast makes him big. And we see Santa Claus as jolly and giving. And they take away the Christian air of judgment attached to Christmas gifts with St. Nicholas. It's the deserving poor who get gifts. In this new American Christmas we've got, everyone gets gifts. Everyone. Nast also put Santa's workshop at the North Pole. And some people say, "Oh, yes, that's because he's saying that he's promoting universalism. Santa Claus is for all children everywhere in the world." Also, he was probably poking fun at all the different countries who were sending competing teams of explorers to the North Pole the first. So he's also poking a little fun at current events at the same time. So that's another, you kind of thing. We tend to be involved in commenting on current events all the time. Nast also is the one who has Santa keeping records of good and bad children. He made that up. And one last, sort of also Unitarian, is Nathaniel Currier of Currier and Ives. And when I hear "Dashing Through the Woods in a One-Horse Open Sleigh," or "Over the River and Through the Woods to Grandmother's House We Go," I have a picture in my head that was printed by Currier and Ives. And there's a good shot, a good chance that you do as well. A lot of Christmas cards have a very Currier and Ives kind of feel too. So what is all this about? It's Christmas. Oh, I should stop. Because we have some carousing to do this afternoon. And I want to say that it's a creation of a new country being created and forming its cultural identity. Some of it is a rescuing of traditions that had kind of been dying out, and or had people had tried to repress, like the Puritans and the colony of Massachusetts outlawing Christmas. But there's also a good bit of political and national agendas. How do folks of different social status relate in this new country where we claim we're not classist? And so what Americans did was to move the celebration of Christmas from the streets into the home, from a religious holiday to a secular holiday. We sort of kept rowdiness for the marginal and underclass, but tried to make it about moral training instead. So we're going to have a tree, and it's going to look fantastic, but it's about teaching you to give gifts, to be generous. There's a nostalgia for the old world traditions among people who are now in cities. This, especially in A Christmas Carol, you see this. It's an urban tale set in a city, but there's a nostalgia for the old country ways. There's an attempt. Christmas, the old holidays had been the 12 days long, the 12 days of Christmas. And now we're kind of compact. This is where we start compacting into one day, which works much better with an urban workforce that needs to get back to work the next day. And you have the Industrial Revolution and the new cult of domesticity. There's a new culture, new way of doing life together that's emerging, and it has to do more with emphasis on the family and the individual, you know, the nuclear family at home. Women, the sort of the female sphere and voice being, you know, you have all these women writers who are part of writing accounts of the Christmas tree and songs, Christmas songs. There's some tension between this new industrial economy and commercialism and anti-commercialism, wanting to teach children to be generous instead of greedy. But there's also, at the same time, there are many, many more goods that are available and affordable to people. So you have greeting cards and books and magazines and novels and sentimental writing. And you have a middle class agenda that's calling for control of behavior and protection of women and children. And also sometimes abolition fell under that agenda too. So there's this concern for protecting everyone who's vulnerable, slaves and children often. Not at the same time, but they were often people, protecting them was of interest to the same sorts of people for the same sorts of reasons. And this, again, tensions between agriculture and industry, and then the rise of poverty in the new urban setting, which to my way of thinking, I think poverty in the city is a different thing than poverty in the country. I wouldn't want to say which is worse, but they're different. They're different. So we have, it's not real clear what's going on, and it's not all necessarily a good thing. Some of it's about trying to manipulate how people feel about each other and how people trying to control behavior. And some of it is just about peace on earth, goodwill to men, and trying to learn how to be the best human beings we can be. Reverend Tracy Springberry says, "It was the Unitarians who wove together Santa Claus, Christmas trees, gift giving around the tree, a focus on charity and peace and goodwill toward all to create the Christmas that the majority of Americans celebrate today." So I wonder, as the majority of Americans changes, as it has changed, we're not the same. When we talk about Americans, we look different now than we did in the middle or the late 19th century. So our holidays shift, and I'm really curious to see where our holiday celebrations go next and why. Reverend Julie Stoneberg assures us, though, that if we long for ways to construct meaning at this time of year, to give form to our values and bring light to its dark days, just like Unitarians and Universalists of yesteryear, we are free to create our own traditions. So we are free to sing Hanukkah songs and solstice songs and Christmas songs all on the same morning. And I'm so glad that we have done that. And I'd like to leave you with a blessing of sorts. This is a poem from, again, another UU minister, Richard Gilbert. And he says this, and I say to you, "Give me more myth and mistletoe, more miracle and mystery. Give me fewer facts and less logic for a time. I know the difference. May I not take for literal what I should take for joy. May I create a religion that not only makes sense, but also makes merry. May I become one who insists upon thinking, but can think my way deep into the soul. May I take this season not so much as a time of the head, as a time of the heart." May it be so. Blessed be.